Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Today is the day the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it, even in the midst of headline news that may be disturbing and troubling. And so we're going to lead off today with a conversation with Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. We are going to talk about the death of Egypt's ousted President Morsi, who died in court while on trial this week in Egypt. We're also going to talk about Iran and I'll just call it the current foment between Iran and the rest of the world. We are going to necessarily after that visit the subject of Israel. I'm also going to have a conversation today with Michael Dawson, who grew up as a child of New Tribes missionaries in Venezuela. He has spent his entire life in the Venezuelan jungle, and he is going to be here to talk about not only his experience, but what's going on in Venezuela today. Bill English will be here. He and I are going to begin what I think will be a months-long effort to draw out, suss out lessons from the life of David on the subject of leadership and what we can learn from David's experience in application to our lives today. And then at the bottom of the second hour, Rondell Trevino is going to be here. He is from the Immigration Coalition. He and I are going to talk about not only the president's tweet related to the planned expulsion, at least according to the president, of quote unquote millions of people from the United States. We're also going to talk about what the president said last night in his speech in Orlando, kicking off his 2020 campaign for a second term as president. So we're going to talk about how people who are here in the United States are feeling about what is being said about them and their immigration status. And that's at the bottom of the second hour. So all of that is up today. And so get ready for an intellectual and spiritual feast as we seek to bring the mind of Christ to bear on the matters of this day. We'll be right back. Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine is back with us this morning. Drew, welcome back.
Good morning, Carmen. Thanks for having me.
Now, this morning when it says we didn't start the fire, I'm gonna ask you in a minute if maybe we did. But let's turn to Egypt first, because I think that folks have certainly heard in the news that the ousted President Morsi had what we all assume was a heart attack and died while on trial, literally in the courtroom. And he has since been buried according to the customs of his religion, which require that to happen within 24 hours. So remind us, if you will, remind us who President Morsi was. And I think as a part of that, remind us what the Muslim Brotherhood is. And then we'll talk about, the government of Egypt today.
Sure. So Mohamed Morsi was the first elected president of Egypt. He replaced Hosni Mubarak in 2012 in an election. And it was a very brief seat on the throne there in Egypt. He was deposed by a coup in 2013. This was the Arab Spring Revolt on Tahrir Square. It was a, famous, CNN's covering it. It's the Twitter revolution, basically, where Egypt kind of rose up and deposed him in a coup. And ever since then, he and many of the members of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is kind of the political party we'll talk about in a second that he was a part of were imprisoned. They were put on trial. He's been on trial since since 2013. And as being, I think, already sentenced to, 40 some odd years in prison, they had charged him with a number of crimes. And it was while he was being processed through the very slow and kind of maybe corrupt Egyptian justice system that, he died apparently of a heart attack in a soundproof cell, which all people who are kind of processed through, defendants who are processed through Egyptian courtrooms are kept in cages. It's an intentional kind of humiliation. And he was silently in that soundproof cage when he died of a heart attack. He was part of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is kind of a pan-Islamic group that is a Sunni-based group. You've got Sunnis and Shia within Islam. It's a Sunni-based group that is really based, has its base in roots in Qatar and in Turkey. And is considered by many countries, including the United States and most other Middle Eastern countries, as a terrorist organization. And they are they're blamed for a whole host of ills and abuses within Egypt when they were in power under Morsi, and terrorist activities across the Middle East. So it's an interesting story. And it's slightly maybe suspicious, but he was probably also under a great deal of stress, having been in trial and facing a long prison term for the last 6 years.
So I just think that my personal reflection when you share all that information, Drew, is to say, okay, there's a reason that the justice system needs to work more quickly, even if the outcome is that you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. At least you know that, and at least you sort of get beyond the trial phase. I mean, I cannot imagine literally being on trial under those circumstances for the kind of period of time that we're talking about. And so, we certainly, you recognize this is not a person who died as a Christian. And so, my grief in this circumstance is very real on that eternal reality. And so I think we'll just set that conversation there. Just remind us what Egypt is like today, particularly for Christians.
Sure. Yeah. Egypt right now is a very inhospitable place for Christians, especially Coptic Christians. Copts are kind of a sect of Christianity that's been based in Egypt really since the beginning of Christianity for the last 2,000 years. And they face enormous persecution within Egypt. And there are Coptic churches that are constantly being attacked. Coptic Christians, which are being, busloads of them as they're going to church, are being shot up by gangs of Islamic terrorists and teens. So it's a very inhospitable place right now for Christians, and especially Coptic Christians, which are a tiny, tiny minority within the country, but yet they're a longstanding minority. And so I would say, to the extent to which American Christians should plug in increasingly to the reality of Christian persecution around the world, they should read these stories and stories like what we hear coming out of Egypt as always, I think, a pivot to the reality of what's actually going on in the country, and especially for our brothers and sisters in Christ to care about that and to pray for them, to lift them up in prayer, but also to help their elected representatives here in the United States engage with these countries, engage with Egypt in a way that hopefully helps ease the suffering of those facing persecution there in the Middle East.
Okay, and then when we come back from the break, Drew and I are going to pivot from Egypt to Iran. So we are going to pivot from a nation that in both of these countries, the dominant religion is Islam, but in Egypt, that is Sunni Islam. And then we're going to pivot to Iran, which is, also a majority Muslim country. I mean, overwhelmingly so. It is a Muslim country. But it's not Sunni, it's Shia. And so when we have this conversation about Iran, we are having a conversation about a nation that is also governed in a way that is very, very different than the United States is governed. And so we are going to have to talk about theocracy. We're going to have to talk about a government that is also understands itself to be the religious system of the people. And so Iran is in the headlines in every way today. And Drew and I are going to talk about that in just a moment. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine is here, and we'll be right back. Returning to my conversation now with Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. And Drew, let's talk about Iran. I'm going to just brief people in case they have missed this. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo insisted on Tuesday that President Trump does not want war with Iran. I'm with him in that. I don't want war with Iran. However, the administration continues to blame the Islamic Republic for what some are describing as mysterious attacks on oil tankers and fortified U.S. And has fortified the U.S. military presence in the region with an additional 1,000 troops in the Middle East. Iran has warned the European nations, and I would say the rest of the world, that it intends to breach within 10 days or by June the 27th the landmark 2015 nuclear deal. And so there's... It's a mess. This is a mess. And then today we hear about a bombing of an ExxonMobil facility in Iraq. Nobody has yet taken responsibility for that or claimed responsibility for that. But it does certainly seem as if tensions in the region are rising aggressively.
Yes. Yeah, there are. This is one of those kind of cocktail situations in which you've got a number of different strands of interests and themes that are all kind of converging in one place. And you've got religious themes and religious conflicts. You've got regional conflicts and interests. And then you've got kind of international and U.S. interests, all of which are mushing together and kind of being stirred together in Iran right now and with the situation with Iran. And I think it has to begin, the story kind of has to begin with the withdrawal, the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA last year. That's a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. It was assigned by the Obama administration and the United Nations, I mean, sorry, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany and Iran. And it was an effort to reduce sanctions and open Iran up economically while limiting Iran's nuclear development and nuclear enrichment. Trump rescinded U.S. involvement in the JCPOA when he took office and began a sanctions regime, rolling out sanctions last year every 3 months or so, increasing sanctions, penalizing European companies and international companies from investing and trading with Iran, trying to isolate Iran further. This is really to punish Iran as a sponsor of terror. Iran sponsors a number of terrorist organizations throughout the Middle East, and the Trump administration, I think, rightly feels that they should be punished for this. The way they're punishing them is by increasing sanctions, isolating them, not trusting them. Iran is attempting to salvage and has been attempting to salvage some measure of this agreement, this JCPOA, with Germany, France, and the UK. But being increasingly isolated, increasingly undergoing economic hardship, they're becoming more and more desperate. And some of that desperation is beginning to spill out as they act out in the Middle East and as they begin to flex their muscle. And part of that is the alleged or supposed attack of two oil tankers just this last week by, I guess, allegedly Iranian forces. Trump has moved a fleet into the Persian Gulf. He has pledged to send 1,000 troops to the Middle East. And so this raises, a number of questions, I think, for the United States. One is really, is there any kind of domestic appetite for military involvement in the Middle East? I mean, Iran is a bad actor. Yes, we all know this. The Middle East is full of bad actors. The Middle East is full of dictatorships and totalitarian regimes, some of which we partner with, some of which we do not. I think we should be wise to recognize that some of what the Trump administration is doing right now is probably spurred on by our partnership with the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, both of which are Sunni Muslim countries, both of which are vehemently anti-Iran, and both of which have really close ties to Jared Kushner and to many people with inside the Trump administration that are really putting, I think, a lot of leverage on the Trump administration to isolate Iran. And they're doing it and using the United States as a weapon, I guess, to hurt this threat that they see in their region, this threat of Iran. So I think the Trump administration should be wise to, yes, I think it's important to stand against terror and to, you know, stand against injustice and to kind of fight for freedom and to limit bad actors. But I don't see, and I would be, especially heading into an election year, think it at all wise to engage in military conflicts abroad, especially in the Middle East, committing U.S. troops in any capacity. I just don't think there's probably much of a domestic appetite for this.
I think that's absolutely fair and a good assessment of where we stand. One of the component parts of this, and maybe the one that is of greatest concern to people who have been paying attention for any period of time, is not just the wider region of the Middle East, because I think when we look at a map of the Middle East, we see, you know, this huge geography of Iran and the huge geography of Saudi Arabia. And then, frankly, we see a lot of little countries, although Iraq is not a small country geographically. There is this little microscopic one over there on the Mediterranean Sea who is our really good friend, and that's Israel. And remind people what Iran's position is in relationship to Israel and why the threat of Iran attaining a nuclear weapon is genuinely an existential threat to our friends in Israel.
Sure. No, that's a very important point. I mean, Iran is a Shia Muslim country. Shia Muslims represent a very small fraction of the Muslim population in the world. Probably 10 to 13% of Muslims in the world are Shia Muslims. The majority of Muslims are Sunni. Shia Muslims and Shiism is a very extreme sect of Islam. And part of that is and part of that vision that Iran has and the Shia Muslims have for Israel is that Israel be eliminated, that Israel doesn't have a right to exist, that Israel is an illegal actor there in the Middle East, and that it should be basically, you know, pushed into the sea. That's certainly, I think, Iran's position and where Iran funds terrorist organizations, whether it's Hezbollah or other organizations, that they work in a way to subvert Israel's dominance in the region and ultimately seek Israel's removal. So it is there is a threat there, and it is a threat that must be met. I would say that Israel is capable of defending itself in a certain extent. I mean, it's a very Israel has nuclear weapons. Israel is a nuclear state. Israel has unmatched, I think, military prowess in the region and organization. And I think what we're seeing now is a weird kind of partnership you have some Sunni countries like Saudi Arabia and Israel that are working kind of together and in concert to limit Iran's influence, because they both see Iran as a threat to the region. So the question here, I think, is should the United States be involved? You know, should we be involved to the extent to which we are committing, you know, U.S. Troops to the region in order to see this prevented? And is military action the best way? I mean, there's an argument out there, and there are people out there, especially that came up with the JCPOA and the Iran deal, as it's commonly known, that say, hey, you know, maybe a way to limit Iran's nuclear development is to try and open it up to the broader world and try and allow the economic influences to influence the country in a way that it would be disadvantageous for them to develop nuclear weapons and become a threat. You know, countries don't want to trade with threats. So let's see if we can open them up and influence them that way. So it's definitely a threat. It's definitely something that I think we need to be concerned about, that we should certainly, you know, pray about. But whether or not we should engage militarily, that's kind of a big question.
Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine, thank you as always. You guys can visit providencemag.com for really everything at the intersection of Christianity and American foreign policy. These guys do a great job. Drew, we'll talk to you next time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Carla.
Let's take a minute to brighten up. Okay, Venezuela continues to be a genuine nightmare situation for the people there. Streams of them continue to seek to extricate themselves from Venezuela and find refuge in neighboring countries. My next guest was born and raised in the jungles of Venezuela. He is the son of New Tribes missionaries who went there in the early 1950s. His name is Michael Dawson. He's the author of several books. He's here to talk about Venezuela. He's also here to talk about, you know, how do you actually share the message of Christ and the good news of the gospel with Stone Age people, Stone Age tribes, in an era when the rest of us are thinking, you know, social media and next gen technologies. So that's all next here on Mornings with Carmen. So we are quickly approaching the end of our fiscal year here at Faith Radio. And the way that I'm characterizing this is it's kind of like the bottom of the ninth of a really good baseball game. And so the score is tight and you are in the on deck circle and you haven't actually come up to bat yet. So, you know, you haven't been into the game to this point. You've been enjoying it. You've been, you know, you're cheering from the sidelines. Well, we need you. We need you to step up to the plate. We need you to do what you can, play your part. If you are a person who benefits every single day, day in and day out from this ministry, we need you to step up to the plate in the bottom of the ninth here at the end of our fiscal year and make a gift. And you can do that by calling 877-933-2484. You can do it by going to myfaithradio.com and hitting the donate button. You can do so on the Faith Radio app if that's how you listen. So give where you listen today and help us finish the year strong. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back.
Millennials have a different view of sexuality than their parents. This is Jim Garlow. With the millennials' generation rejection of traditional values, sexuality is seen as being without any boundaries. Majorities of them believe in cohabitation and sex before marriage. They also support so-called gay marriage. Having children out of wedlock? No problem. Pornography? Acceptable. And what about getting married themselves? According to them, marriage can wait until much later in life, if it ever happens at all. Concerning sexual behavior, millennials hold this view. If it makes someone happy and doesn't hurt me, fine. Who are we to judge what makes someone else happy? So individual preferences and personal pleasures have trumped truth, results, traditional values, and biblical morality. Clearly, we need to have an effective conversation with our millennials. Stay tuned. This is Jim Garlow.
Michael Dawson joins me now, among other things. He is the author of a new book called Growing Up Yanomamu. Hopefully I am pronouncing that correctly. And if I'm not, Michael, I feel confident that you'll correct me. Welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
No, you did fine. You did fine. It's called Growing Up Yanomamu. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. So you have such a unique unique experience in the world today, and you have a unique perspective on what's going on in the nation of Venezuela. So if we could start there, give us your perspective in terms of what is happening in Venezuela today. And then we're going to dive into your story of literally growing up in the jungles of Venezuela and then continuing the work that your parents started there as missionaries. So give us your perspective on what's happening in Venezuela today.
Well, I think the easiest way to explain and tell what's happening in Venezuela today is the same thing that's happened everywhere in the world down through history where socialism has been tried. It has totally, totally failed. Remember, Venezuela is a very, very rich country in natural resources. They sit on the world's largest known oil reserves, and yet there is no fuel. People are rationing fuel, and it's rationing everything else as well. It's funny. I heard somebody say one time that if you put a socialist in charge of the Sahara Desert, in 3 years they'd be rationing sand. And I laughed at that because it sounds so ridiculous. But basically, in a thumbnail, that's exactly what has happened in Venezuela.
So that's an interesting comparison to make, because I think that you're exactly right. And you've put your finger on, you know, the chief concern. What are you hearing from people in Venezuela? It's really helpful for folks in America and Canada who are listening right now to understand what the experience of people in Venezuela is today, because we cycle through the news pretty quickly and we turn our attention to the next hot spot and the next place where, you know, people are in trouble and facing real challenges. But the people of Venezuela, this is going to be a long slog, and it's desperate. There's desperate circumstances. Share with us what you know about what people in Venezuela are facing right now.
You're right, and the word you used is right. Things are desperate. There's no food. There's no medicine. When we left the jungle, almost a little over 3 months ago, we did not even have one aspirin in the village, and our village is pretty close to 700 people, and we deal with on a regular basis people all up and down our river, which is probably totals roughly 2,000 or 3,000 people. And we are their only source of medical help, and we did not even have one aspirin. And the situation out in towns is almost worse, because at least the Yanomami have their meager gardens and they can hunt and fish out of the rivers, and yet the people out in town, they have nothing. They are literally starving in the streets. It's very sad. It's very, very sad, because Venezuela is such a beautiful country, such a beautiful, beautiful country. And yet the turmoil and the heartbreak there is just I can't even express it. It's difficult to express. And both Kayla and I, my wife, Kayla, we both have family in Venezuela now. And things are just very, very, very difficult.
OK, Michael. Sorry, I have to cough. You talk for a minute about where you live. Talk about your village and talk about growing up there while I push my cough button.
Okay. My parents went to Venezuela in 1953 before I was born. And I was actually born, had the privilege of being born right up in the Amazon jungle, and grew up with the Yanomami natives. And their first language was actually my first language. I learned English, when I started missionary school when I was 7 years old, and I consider it a real, real privilege to have grown up with the Yanomami. They're just a fascinating people. We love them, and I consider it a real privilege to have been able to continue working with them. I went to Venezuela as a missionary. I came back in 1975, went through all the missionary training, and then returned to Venezuela in January of 1981, and have been working with the Yanomami ever since. And they're just a wonderful people to work with. And people think, well, they're primitive, and we were told so many times, leave them alone, they're happy. What gives you the right to take your religion, your Western religion, down to the Yanomami? Well, this was brought home to me to be just nothing but a lie many, many times, because like one example, I was coming down the river in a dugout canoe with an outboard motor, and I had my headphones on, and I'm listening to Holy, Holy, Holy. And the third verse says, though the darkness hide thee, though the eyes of sinful man thy glory may not see. And a friend of mine lived in a village right around there. So I stopped there to visit with him. He introduced me to his uncle, and he was from way interior. He'd never seen white people before. And I could tell from his eyes that he was a witch doctor. So I started talking with him, and I started sharing with him about God and everything. And he kept nodding his head and clicking his tongue. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, you're talking about the one who can't be seen. And remember, I just finished listening to a song that said, the darkness hide thee, though the eyes of sinful man thy glory may not see. And this old witch doctor says, oh, you're talking about the one who can't be seen. And he finished up with Yaiwano Naburewa, which means the enemy god. And to me, it's always so sad that the Yanomami, they know so much about God, and yet they think he's the enemy god. And that's the part that we're there to share with them, is that he's not the enemy. He loved them so much that he sent his only begotten son, that whosoever believes would not perish but have everlasting life. So they're exciting people to work with, and they keep us on our toes.
So I'm talking with Michael Dawson. He's the author of Growing Up Yanomamu. I'm going to spell that Y-A-N-O-M-A-M-O so that you can Google it. Growing Up Yanomamu today. He and I are going to continue our conversation. And I'm going to ask Michael, for those of us living in the United States who now actually encounter people who follow dark arts and people who recognize the demonic as the spiritual to which they bow down in this life. I'm going to ask this missionary to equip us to speak the truth of the gospel and introduce people to Jesus in the culture of the United States of America, where people follow dark religions today. So that conversation up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Talking with author Michael Dawson. He is also a missionary in Venezuela. His newest book, Growing Up Yanomamu Today, is available. What it means to walk by faith and not by sight. Michael, I would love for you to equip us, because those of us living in the United States of America, we may have imagined a false reality, and that would be that we live in a place quite different than where you live. You live in a physical jungle. We absolutely live in a jungle of ideas here in the U.S. today. We live in a place where we may not be able to recognize witch doctors on the street, but we have more than a million people in America actively practicing witchcraft as Wiccans and pagans and self-identified witches. And then we have this very real challenge of encountering the demonic, but having no language and no ability to describe it as such. Equip us as U.S. Christians to do what you do on the mission field every day in confronting false religion.
Interesting question. You know, the funny thing is that I remember years ago looking at National Geographic covers, and it seemed like back then, I don't know if they still do, I haven't seen the covers for a while, but it seemed like they would always put on people with the weird tattoos and the piercings in the face and the sticks sticking out of their the septum of their noses, their cheeks, their, you know, and just the ears, and that was considered pagan. Now I tell you, you go to your nearest Walmart and you could get any number of National Geographic covers just by taking pictures of the people that go to Walmart, and every bit is pagan. And we as Christians in the United States have basically rolled over and played dead instead of heeding the call. You know, the Bible tells us that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and wickedness in high places. And while I don't believe we need to be afraid and you know of this power, we definitely need to know that we are in a battle. Satan knows he's in a battle. The demons know they're in a battle. We as Christians just want to ignore the battle and go on our merry way and think everything's okay. Everything's not okay. Satan is in a fight, especially for our children today. You can see that in just in the Pokemon cartoons and other things like that that I've had witch doctors in the jungle tell me, and ex-witch doctors, strong Christian men who used to be a witch doctor tell me that, you know, they can name but when you show them a picture of Pokemon, they can name that demon. They can tell you all his attributes. And if you look at the picture in the book, it's exactly right. They know exactly who they're talking about and what they're describing. And one witch doctor told me, he said, these are the ones that the children are first introduced to, because these are the ones that get the children into the spirit world. And we think they're just harmless toys. And, you know, I'm sure there's so many other examples that I could name, but time doesn't allow it.
But you do talk about some of this in the book, and it's a book that is full of personal stories, and I would say it's a book that really does equip Christians who recognize the challenge of the changing culture in which we live here. I mean, it's interesting to note, Michael, that somebody who is literally working with a tribe that many around the world would consider Stone Age, you're really on the cutting edge of the ministry that all of us need to be equipped to do every day, because we now have neighbors and members of our own family who absolutely are worshiping false gods. And you know them. You've met them. You've been with people who openly acknowledge the reality of those false gods, and you're actually able to equip us to speak into that with light and truth and hope.
Yeah, and I started writing books down there. It was funny. We were in the NICU, neonatal intensive care unit, we had a daughter that was born grievously ill. We did not know if she was going to make it or not for weeks. And so I started writing. I basically started writing her little story and went on from there to telling my story. And the more I got into the stories, the more I realized how fascinating, utterly fascinating, the Yanomama's views on the spirit world are. They do not separate the spiritual from the physical. You know, we as Americans, if we can't touch it and feel it, it's not real. The Yanomama believe the spiritual is very, very real, which I believe their viewpoint is much more biblical than our American Christian viewpoint regarding the spiritual. You do not have to convince a Yanomama of spiritual warfare. They are tuned to the spiritual warfare, and as witch doctors, they are involved in it on their own with these spirits all the time. But the interesting thing is when these guys do become Christians and they see the glory of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they are freed from the bondage that they're in to the spirit world, man, I tell you, their testimonies will just blow you away. And that's what I sought to capture in my books, is a testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ in working with the Yanomama.
Okay, how can people find you? We're going to tell them that they can find the book on Amazon, Growing Up Yanomamu. Tell us, though, how they can find you.
Okay, the books are for sale on Amazon and probably many other sites as well. But to be honest, we are really encouraging anybody that listens to us to go to you can go to my Facebook page, Michael Dawson. Or I have another page called "I Can See the Shore," which is the title of my second book, and there we give the website of where we sell the books.
Perfect.
When we sell a book on Amazon, you know, the royalties are pennies on the dollar, whereas the books that we sell through our website, 100% of the monies raised from the sale of those books goes back into the ongoing work with the Yanomama. And right now that money is going to the Yanomama Emergency Medical Fund, because the people have basically been totally abandoned. All indigenous people have been abandoned. And so their only source of any type of medical help, anything at all, are just us as missionaries. And so the book money comes in very handy for that. And you think, well, what does the Yanomama need, you know, medical wise? Well, if there's an emergency, if somebody breaks a leg, we have a little girl out in town right now. She's 3 years old. She fell out of a tree and broke her upper leg, both places, both bones. And it cost us $1,400 just to get her out to town. And because the hospital is so poor, they have absolutely nothing in the hospital. We had to put her in a private clinic, and then we'll have to fly her back home again at the end of this time. So the medical costs right now are just horrendous. And so the book money does help with that.
Okay, so if people just type in, I can see the shore in Google, you will find Michael Dawson. You can also find him on Facebook. Michael, thank you so much for being here today, and blessings upon you and your family as you return home to Venezuela.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure to be here with you this morning.
We'll be right back. Okay, so I'm going to just tell you what I did was I typed in I can see the shore into Google, and it actually then sent me the first link is to Michael Dawson's Facebook page, which is also I can see the shore. So let me recommend that you do that. I find the Facebook page I can see the shore much easier to navigate, and so let me encourage you to visit with him there. You can post, you can see pictures, you can get the book. And it's hard for me to encourage you more significantly to sit at the feet of missionaries today. Yes, we need to be praying for them, but we also need to be thanking God for the way that they bring the gospel back to us in ways that we need in this culture. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.